Baghdad.
The National League's victory in Major League Baseball's All-Star Game not only ends a 14-year streak of losses in that game for the league, but it also gives the National League team the home field advantage in this year's World Series. That concerns New York Yankees and American League team manager Joe Girardi.
There's a lot of disappointment. I mean, the home field advantage is extremely important. So whoever comes out of the American League is going to have to work a little bit harder. And for the streak to break, and that's disappointing as well. But we have an opportunity to start a new one next year.
The National League down the American League 3-1 in the All-Star game. Atlanta's Brian McCann was named the game's most valuable player. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programming is made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, featuring locally grown and organic produce, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields also offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating.
And good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, for people who are tuning in here expecting our monthly program on nutrition with Susan Kundrot, we're sorry that Susan couldn't be with us this time around. She will be here, we certainly hope, in August to take your questions about diet and nutrition. And Celeste Quinn will be hosting the program. Instead, this morning, in fact, in both hours, we have programs from the Focus archives, one that I did and one that Celeste did. So we'll get you started here with a program that we first broadcast on June 3rd. It's all about the history of the oral contraceptive. So in this hour, in fact, in both hours this morning, we will not be taking calls. It's been 50 years now since the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the first oral contraceptive. Many people had an almost utopian vision of the pill. They thought that it would help to eradicate global poverty, that it would end unwanted pregnancy, that it would ensure stable marriages. Our guest for this hour, historian Elaine Tyler May, says really the pill did none of those things, although it did become a very important tool for the empowerment of women. This morning we'll consider some of the myths and realities of the birth control pill as we talk with Elaine Tyler May about her book America and the Pill, A History of Promise, Peril, and Liberation. That's the subtitle. It's published by Basic Books. It's out now if you'd like to read the book. Elaine Tyler May is Regents Professor of American Studies and History at the University of Minnesota, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief. You can call. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, use the number 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We do also have email, so you may send your comments along that way. Write to will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, questions, comments are certainly welcome. Professor May, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
There are a number of things here that we can get into in some detail, but as a way of starting, I'm certain that there are certain big trends that people point to, and they say, this thing, that was the work of the pill. Like, for example, they say that the pill was the thing that ignited the sexual revolution. And they say that the pill was the thing that really worked to liberate women. And they say that the pill resulted in a big boom in people having sex outside of marriage. And they say the pill was responsible for a big drop in American fertility rates. And what you argue in the book, and we can talk about that in some detail, is that all of those trends were really in place and working their way along at the time that the pill came along. So, in fact, you argue that the pill didn't really do any of that.
Well, that's right. The pill, as a causal factor in any of those large social trends, is probably pretty unlikely, and we don't really have any evidence that the pill was the engine that caused those big, major changes to happen. certainly played a role, but it wasn't the role that is usually attributed to the pill. The pill did a lot of things, but it didn't do those things.
Yeah. And it did, however, have a very significant impact on family life in America, particularly for middle class people, because as again you argue in the book that it was really that it was the pill that made it possible for women to work and to think about having a career and also to have a family.
Yes, it certainly did that, because it was we know what did the pill actually do. The pill prevented pregnancy. We know it did that. That's not a myth. The pill was the most effective product for birth control that had ever become available, and that effectiveness, plus the fact that it was really completely in the control of women. This was a product that prevented pregnancy without the participation or cooperation or even necessarily the knowledge of the woman's husband or sex partner. And there had never been a birth control device of any sort that worked in that way. It also, of course, separated the act of sex from the act of contraception. And so those three parts of the pill's innovation, the fact that it was not connected to the sex act, that it was totally in women's control, and that it was so effective if used properly, really added up to a revolutionary contraceptive. And if you put that together with the huge changes that were taking place in the country at the time, most particularly the new opportunities that were opening up to women, then you can really see how the pill was a very powerful and important tool for women to be able to take advantage of these new opportunities and really not only control their fertility, but to control their lives and reach for aspirations that wouldn't have been possible in the past.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting to, if you, and again, this gets to the issue of did the pill result in a lot of premarital sex, that if you look at who it was that was taking the pill, particularly in the first years that it was available, it was married women who were
taking the pill. Right, it was married women. Single women had a very hard time getting hold of the pill. We have to remember that birth control of any kind was illegal in about 22 states. So married women, single women, no one could get the pill unless in certain circumstances where it was considered medically necessary. And, of course, it didn't mean that women weren't getting the pill in those situations. There were certainly plenty of sympathetic doctors who were willing to say that there were health issues involved. But on the other hand, in 1960, when the pill appeared, sexual attitudes and behaviors had been changing for a very long time, and they continued to change. But in 1960, the double standard was still very strong. There was a lot of shame and guilt and condemnation and taboo attached to premarital sex, especially for women, not necessarily for men, but certainly for women. And the arrival of the pill didn't suddenly eradicate all of those social attitudes and all of those cultural traditions. So they were in the process of changing. All of those ideas and attitudes and behaviors were changing. But the pill didn't have a big impact on that, especially because it was so difficult for single women to get them.
Yeah.
Now, there were single women who did get hold of the pill. We know this. But they were the exceptions and not the rule.
And just to underscore something that you said that people now might find very surprising, there were, in fact, there were some states where it was illegal, the pill was illegal for unmarried women. But in fact, at the point that we're talking about, there were some states where contraception was illegal.
Yes, for anyone.
For
and
anyone.
It wasn't until 1965 that the Supreme Court ruled those laws unconstitutional, but only for married people. It wasn't until 1972 that the Supreme Court extended that right to unmarried people.
So that would have been for the first 12 years that the pill was available.
Right.
There would have been some states where for unmarried women it would have been illegal.
Right.
It's also true that if you look at fertility rates for American women in the period before the pill, that actually by world standards, fertility rates for American women were relatively low. And I think one of the things that you point out is even if you look at the period between 1800 and 1900, that fertility rates fell actually very significantly over that century. What were women using to try to prevent pregnancy?
Well, in the 19th century, there were a lot of ways that women prevented pregnancy. One was abortion, which was pretty well accepted until the mid to late 19th century. Custom and tradition had it that abortion was pretty well acceptable up until what was called quickening, which was the time that a woman could feel the fetus moving inside her body, and that would be sometime in the fourth month. And so abortion was not unusual, and it was not illegal either. It wasn't until later in the century that laws against abortion began to be created and enforced. Another way was late marriage, and a lot of women knew that the arrival of marriage meant the arrival of babies, and particularly the health hazards and debilitating possibilities that childbirth entailed. There was still a lot of injury and death for women in childbirth, and of course the burdens of child-rearing were quite intense, and these were years where if you married and had children, it was really almost impossible to do anything else. So women who did have aspirations in the 19th century for any kind of career tended to opt out of marriage altogether. And what we see also is the age of marriage trending up in the 19th century, and that also meant that there would be fewer children because there would be you'd get married later and have fewer years of childbearing. There were also a lot of products that were available for women to prevent pregnancy. There were barrier methods. There were versions of the early diaphragm called pessaries. There was the condom. There was coitus interruptus, which was used very routinely among married people not to get pregnant. And so there were birth control options that were available. They, of course, were not as effective as the methods that we have available today, but they did work. And if you put together all of those forces, including also sexual restraint, which was recommended for men as well as women by 19th century middle class standards, then you can see how the birth rate would drop pretty much in half throughout those 100 years.
Our guest in this hour of focus, Elaine Tyler May. She is professor of American Studies and History at the University of Minnesota. We're talking about some of what you will find in a book that she's published. It looks at the history and the impact of the birth control pill on America, American society. The title is America and the Pill. It is published by Basic Books. It's out now in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that certainly in the beginning, the first years of the pill was available, it was very difficult for unmarried women to get, and in fact, as you pointed out, for the first 12 years that it was available in some states, it was actually illegal for unmarried women to get the pill. So the vast majority of women who took it were married women. And if you look at the thinking of the people who really promoted the development of the pill, that was in fact what they had in mind. That is, that they were concerned about women who were having baby after baby after baby, thought that for a variety of reasons that was not good for their health, and what they were looking for was something that would help married women plan and regulate their pregnancies.
Yes, that's true. But on the other hand, there was also a hope at the time that the pill would reduce or eliminate unwed and unwanted pregnancy. And the idea here was that there were obviously a lot of women who were having sex outside of marriage and having babies as a result. A lot of the early developers of the pill did not think that the pill would contribute to what they called promiscuity, a word that they only used in reference to women, never in reference to men. But the thinking at the time for many of these folks was that there were always going to be women who would have sex without being married, but the availability of the pill would mean that they wouldn't get pregnant, and so they would be preventing unwanted pregnancies among the unmarried in particular. So there was a sense that the pill would have an application for unmarried women in the sense that it would, ideally, it would prevent unwed pregnancy.
Hmm. There's certainly been a lot of attention paid to the medical researchers, the male medical researchers, who did the work on the pill and competing claims to be the father, quote-unquote, of the pill. One of the things that you have really tried to do in this book is to call attention to the women that you say truly were the mothers of the pill, and two people that you single out in particular were Margaret Sanger, who was a lifelong advocate of birth control. She actually coined the term. And a woman who was a friend of hers, a feminist and philanthropist, a woman named Catherine McCormick, who really provided the money for the research that led to the development of the pill.
Yes, that's right. I certainly wouldn't want to diminish the importance of the research scientists and clinical physicians who were involved in the development of the pill. Obviously, their work was critically important, and the pill would not have come about without their efforts, and there were lots of them. Some of the names we are more familiar with, of course, John Rock, Gregory Pincus, Carl Gerassi. These were some, not the only ones. And there were also some women scientists and physicians who were involved in the development and testing of the pill. But most of those developers were men because at the time most of the people in the fields of science and medicine were men. But it's also really important to understand that there was a lot of reluctance on the part of institutions with money to invest in the pill in the 1950s. It was still considered somewhat scandalous on some level. Pharmaceutical companies were reluctant to actually promote clinical trials for the pill as a contraceptive. They were working on the pill, actually the same compound, as a treatment for infertility, and that was, of course, respectable. But not so respectable in terms of contraception. They were afraid that their companies might be boycotted by the Catholic Church or considered somehow disreputable. The U.S. government wouldn't invest. President Eisenhower said that this is nothing that the government should be involved in, so we don't see any funding coming out of the NSF or the NIH or any other science foundations associated with the government. Nobody was willing to really put in money in these early years specifically for contraceptive application of these hormonal compounds. And it was McCormick and Sanger who came together in the 1950s. And as you said, they were lifelong friends. They had met in the suffrage movement in the early 20th century. And by the 1950s, they were both in their 70s, and they just decided they would get together and make this happen. And so it was Sanger and McCormick, and people know the name Margaret Sanger more than they know Catherine McCormick, but she was a fascinating woman. She was the second woman ever to graduate from MIT. She had a degree in biology, so she did have a science background, and she had a lot of money. She had been married to the son of Cyrus McCormick, who established International Harvester Company, and after he died, she had a huge amount of money at her disposal, and she just came to Sanger and said, let's make this happen. So the two of them, really, with the money and the expertise and the political and medical connections that they brought together, they were the ones who found Gregory Pincus and his laboratory and began working with him, and then later with John Rock, and the story unfolds from there. But it was their funding, really, it was McCormick's money, single-handedly, that gave the initial research the boost that it needed to get off the ground at that time.
Yeah, this was something that Sanger, I think, had been thinking about and interested in for a long time, based on some of her experiences working in public health and seeing women, particularly poor women, who were having multiple pregnancies. And she would talk about the fact that wouldn't it be great if we had a magic pill, something that women could just take, and
yes,
that would take care of the problem, that would provide that kind of control of their fertility. Was there something, though, at a particular point that really motivated Catherine McCormick to say, now is the time for us to do this?
Well, there were a few things. You're absolutely right about Margaret Sanger, and she first had the idea of a pill in 1912. She actually said, you know, wouldn't it be great to have a pill that would provide contraception? And it wasn't only her work as a nurse in poor areas where she saw women weaken and die as a result of either too many children or botched abortions, but in her own life. Her mother had 11 children, 18 pregnancies, mother, and her mother died at the age of 50, and she is convinced that her mother died because of having too many children and too many pregnancies, and she felt that it was so important for women like her mother as well to have access to contraception. McCormick, one of the reasons for the timing, of course, well, there were a number of reasons. One was that there was a by this time, a research program in process using hormones for the treatment of infertility, and it was pretty well known that by the mid-50s that this hormonal compound would suppress ovulation. And doctors were beginning to test these compounds in what came to be known as the Rock rebound. John Rock was the doctor who was testing this particular kind of formulation for infertility. The idea that if you would give a woman this drug that would suppress ovulation, when you withdrew the drug, her body would spring back into shape and her ovaries would begin to produce and ovulate. And so they knew that while on this drug, ovulation wouldn't take place. So obviously it's briefly preventing pregnancy with the hope that withdrawing it would create the conditions for pregnancy. So they knew that this was in the works, and of course a lot of doctors and women were already using the pill for this purpose. It was approved in the mid-50s by the FDA for this purpose, and interestingly enough, suddenly 500,000 American women showed up at their doctors requesting this pill for, you know, what they called menstrual irregularities or some other kind of cycle problem. For most of these women, this was something that had never been diagnosed or treated before, and it was a wink-wink situation because the women knew and their doctors knew that they were really coming for this pill because they knew that it would prevent pregnancy. So on one level, this was a time when the research in reproductive medicine was really taking off. The field of reproductive medicine was growing. And for Sanger and McCormick, there were other reasons. McCormick's husband had suffered from schizophrenia, and she spent most of her time and effort and money while he was alive trying to find a cure and support research efforts into schizophrenia research. And after he died, she then came to Sanger and said, well, you know, I've done what I can for schizophrenia research. Let's work on birth control, and let's see if we can get this pill to be developed and marketed. And so it was a combination of developments in the field of reproductive medicine and the fact that McCormick was now ready to really turn her attention and her resources to this effort. Mm-hmm.
Well, just to, I have a caller here I want to get right to, but just to be clear, so there were hormones that were available and that were used by physicians for these. They were labeled for these things, for infertility, for menstrual irregularity.
Correct.
But, of course, what they knew was that during the time that the women were taking them, it suppressed ovulation, so it effectively was a contraceptive. And as you said, lots and lots of women showed up at their doctors with these complaints that probably they didn't really have, but they knew, and the physicians knew, what they really wanted was they wanted it for birth control. So
exactly.
It seemed, though, that then it wouldn't have been that much of a leap. You knew that it would do that from that point to did they have to do much before they got to actually human trials with women taking the pill for that purpose?
Yes, because the big difference here was short-term versus long-term use.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing you have to remember about the pill is it was the first pharmaceutical product ever to be developed to be used on healthy people. Mm. You know, it's one thing to treat a condition that needs to be cured, and it's another thing to give a medication, a very powerful medication, for long periods of time, in many cases many years, to women who are otherwise completely healthy. So it was no small thing to make the leap from short-term use for infertility or menstrual irregularities to long-term use for contraceptive purposes.
We have a caller, and let's talk with him. Someone on a cell phone in Cisna Park. This is on our line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Great show. Fascinating with regards to the history. I agree with your guest. 50 years ago, yeah, that shouldn't be discounted. The landscape of this country has changed quite a bit since then, so I think it's important to remember where everyone was coming from 50 years ago. But I had two quick questions. Since I'm on a cell, I'll ask them and ring off and listen off air. I know we talked about what people thought the pill was responsible for. That turned out that it wasn't. But I was wondering if your guest could talk about some of the other benefits from a medical background that the pill has played inadvertently after 50 years of research, some of the other benefits. And then I was just wondering if your guest could maybe, just wax philosophical and was wondering if the pill was an eventuality, if it wasn't discovered 50 years ago, would somebody would have had to discover it by now? Or what would be the impact on society without a pill? And I'll go ahead and listen off there. Thanks.
All right.
Well, those are really, really excellent questions. In terms of the medical benefits, I have to give a disclaimer on one level. I'm a historian. I'm not a scientist or a physician or a medical researcher or even an expert in medical history. But I do know that over time, there have certainly been not only risks and side effects associated with the pill, but also there have been situations where for some women there seem to be some medical benefits. The pill seems to be protective against certain kinds of cancers and other problems. And, of course, depending on the woman who's taking the pill, there are some things that are beneficial for some women and not beneficial for others. So the kinds of side effects that show up in any given woman's body might be positive for some and not so positive for others. So to some extent, those are individual. But I'm not qualified enough in the scientific area to be able to give you specifics on the on particular medical benefits that have come about as a result of the pill, aside from the contraceptive benefits. The question about the pill's inevitability, gosh, you know, that's such an interesting question. Would the pill have been developed at some point, if not in the 1950s? Probably, sure, because so much research was developing in these years on hormonal kinds of contraceptive pills and other sorts of pills. So I think we'd have to say yes. It's very likely something like this would have come along, if not exactly the same thing.
I think one of the things that you've talked about is that the development was made possible, again, by private money, and that the big pharmaceutical companies were very hesitant to get involved in contraception. They were afraid that they would attract the ire of the Roman Catholic Church. They were just sort of concerned that something about it might strike people as unsavory, and that would rub off on them in a negative way. Eventually, the big drug companies have made a lot of money from selling the pill. You would have thought that maybe at some point, maybe they would have felt attitudes would have changed enough so that, and they would have recognized the commercial potential here, so that you think sooner or later, at some point, they would have said, "We need to do this because there's an opportunity for us to make a lot of money."
Oh, you bet! The demand was so obvious, and you know, the birth control pill in all of its varieties, it's one of the most successful pharmaceutical products ever invented. So I think there's no question. And I think also pharmaceutical companies were getting a suggestion of that in the mid-1950s when 500,000 women showed up at their doctors for something that was not yet even approved for that purpose. So the demand would have certainly been there, and that would have stimulated. These are companies. They're in the business of making money, and at some point they would have realized that the benefits would have far outweighed any detriment.
Yeah, and just to drop this, which I think is an amazing statistic, that today 80% of women of childbearing age have taken the pill at some point in their lives.
Right.
That's just an amazing. What is the number? Do you know? Say today, how many women are taking oral contraceptives today?
I've heard the term 100 million around the world, but you know, who knows? Hard to know.
All right, we'll talk with next with someone in Bartlett, Illinois, line number one. Hello.
Yeah. Good morning. You know, my concern though is when they come out with all these drugs like the pill, they didn't study it long enough. But I was just talking about something similar to this this morning to a friend of mine. We were talking about other drugs, but this whole topic is like, you know, they put it out in 10 years or 12 years, but we're finding it now that it's 20 years or something down the road, you start having problems with other parts of your body from taking, you know, drugs. It makes me wonder if the way we develop these drugs or develop anything, we don't study it enough. I know it's probably taxing. People say, well, we need it sooner, you know, than later. But, you know, I know some of these drugs that they take, you know, they give you these big disclaimers that take you half an hour. If you watch the commercials, it destroys other things outside of what it's supposed to work on. It makes me wonder what, you know, if we're doing this the right way or what. I just kind of wonder what your comment would be on that. Do you think we wait long enough, or do you think it's not long enough at all, or what? I'll get off and listen.
I think that the caller makes the point. I think a lot of people would make that point that when a drug is first introduced, in a sense, it's still an experiment. Because in the testing phase, you know, you only give it to so many people. Maybe you give it to a significant number, but you still don't really know what the effect of a medication is going to be until you've had millions of people take it over an extended period of time.
Right. Now, the caller made a really, really good point, and that was a very good question. I think there's a number of issues here that we need to look at. The first one is that at the time that the pill was first developed and approved, there was a huge amount of pressure to get the pill to market as soon as possible because, you know, women were already taking it, and they were taking it for contraceptive purposes, and we knew that. Secondly, you know, the big problem with the pill when it first came out was the high dosage of hormones. There was a pill that was available that was approved. Only one pill was initially approved, Anavid, made by Searle. It had 10 milligrams of hormone. That is just huge compared to the pills today, which are a mere fraction of that amount. But the researchers at the time knew that the 10-milligram pill worked. They knew that if a woman took that pill, it would prevent pregnancy if the pill was taken properly. Now, what they didn't know is if they dropped the amount of hormone in a particular pill, they didn't know if that would be as effective. And what they couldn't say to women in 1960 is, look, if you join this trial and we try a lower dose pill and it doesn't work, don't worry. If you happen to get pregnant, we'll know within hours or days and we can take care of it. These were the days when, of course, abortion was not legal. And so the researchers couldn't offer a backup to any woman who would be willing to join a trial. So they wanted to go with a pill that they knew would prevent pregnancy. And it is true that after the pill was approved, over the next several years, a number of side effects and dangers and risks were identified, and then new compounds were developed that were less dangerous. Now, today, the pill is by far the most well-researched pharmaceutical out there. There is really no other medication of any kind that's been studied to the extent that the pill has been studied in terms of the number of women who have taken it as part of clinical trials and the number of years that it's been studied. So today we know that the pill is just about the most widely and thoroughly studied medication out there. On the other hand, the caller makes a very good point that there are sometimes market pressures that will bring a drug to market very quickly because the demand is so obvious. Let's take, for example, Viagra, a very, very popular pharmaceutical product, probably the most or one of the most popular and widely sold and purchased drugs out there. And that was brought to market very quickly and sold very widely, even though we know and, you know, it's widely known that there are very serious dangers that can be associated with Viagra, but the popularity of the product is such that it's used widely anyway, even though it was, you know, brought to market pretty quickly. So, you know, these situations are a combination, of course, of efforts to create products that where there's a demand for them, and also to meet, you know, the scientific requirements for safety that the FDA has in place. And so some products are brought to market sooner, others less soon. And in the case of Viagra, also very much like the birth control pill, the same compound was used for other purposes before it was used for the purpose that is now indicated. Infertility in the case of the pill and something like Viagra was for circulatory problems. So the way that medications come to market really varies depending on the problem being solved and the urgency and the demand. But the caller is absolutely right that there's, you know, once you begin to mess with the body's chemistry, there's going to be consequences, and sometimes we don't know what they are until the medication has been out there on the market for a long enough time to really see.
We have about 15 minutes left in this hour of Focus. I'd like to introduce again our guest, Elaine Tyler-May. She is a Regents Professor of American Studies and History at the University of Minnesota. She's the author of a number of books, including her most recent, which is titled America and the Pill, A History of Promise, Peril, and Liberation. It's published by Basic Books. It takes a look at the development of the oral contraceptive 50 years ago, depending on what you pick, whether you pick the initial or final approval. It was either 50 years ago last month or 50 years ago this month that the pill was approved by the FDA. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And just to round out that point, I think it is true that even when this high-dose pill was approved, there were physicians that had concerns about the potential effects or negative effects of taking hormones at this dosage, and one of the big changes that's occurred over time is the fact that today's pills have the amount of hormone that's in them is much, much less than it was when the pill first came out. At what point did the people who worked on this start turning their attention to a lower dose pill?
Well, almost immediately they began turning their attention to a lower dose pill, and that research continued for many years, and in fact is still continuing today. There are always new products that are being developed and new compounds that are being tested. So those studies really began pretty much immediately.
All right. Let's take some other calls here. We have a couple of people. They're both in Urbana. First, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have some questions for the caller about who were the test subjects. I've read a little bit about that, and I just wanted to hear more about who was tested on and what the effects were on those people. I know, like, Puerto Ricans and things like that, so I have some questions. I wanted to hear what you said.
All right.
Oh, I got them. Listen. Thank you.
Yes.
Another great question, yes. Well, there were tests that were going on all over the country and all over the world in the late 50s and the early 60s. And yes, the caller is right to point to the Puerto Rico study. That was one of the largest and over the years has been considered one of the most controversial because, of course, women were poor and there were all of these questions about testing a very powerful drug on this population. But all of the medical history that I have read, including from a wide range of very skeptical medical historians about these early tests because they have, to some extent, gotten some bad press, they are all convinced that these tests in Puerto Rico were done scrupulously. One of the things that's important to realize about these tests in Puerto Rico is that John Rock and Gregory Pincus were both working in Massachusetts. And at the time, birth control of any kind was illegal in Massachusetts. John Rock could not test the pill for contraceptive purposes in Massachusetts without getting arrested because it was illegal. Where could they test it? Well, there were some tests going on in California. There were tests going on in other countries, in other states. But Puerto Rico was a really good place because, for one thing, at the time in Puerto Rico, there was a network of birth control clinics. And what they were offering was sterilization. And women, you know, had only really one option if they wanted fewer children, and that was to have their tubes tied. And the women in Puerto Rico desperately wanted a reversible contraceptive because the drastic operation that was involved for a tubal ligation meant they could never have children, and of course it was also a dangerous procedure, being surgery. So when it was proposed that this whole system of birth control clinics in Puerto Rico were already in place and the demand was so high, in fact, when they began the clinical trials of the pill in Puerto Rico, they had so many volunteers that they couldn't take them all. They had waiting lists. The women of Puerto Rico were desperate for an alternative to sterilization and really eager to take part in these tests. So the eagerness and interest was there. The infrastructure was there. And the way that the studies were conducted in Puerto Rico were scrupulous according to the standards of the time. And again, we have to realize that those standards are very different than they are today. But according to what was standard procedure, what was ethical and normal for scientific research, the Puerto Rico studies were done very scrupulously. Now, there were some studies at the time that were not ethical and not scrupulous under anybody's consideration. For example, the pill was also tested in prisons and in mental hospitals. And these were women and in some cases men, actually, who were given the birth control pill, who would receive no benefit from it, who were not at risk of pregnancy, and there was nothing that they were getting from it, and they were coerced because they were in a situation either in prison or in a mental hospital where they had no choice. So there were some studies, smaller ones, very small, but nonetheless there were some studies in situations that certainly anyone today, and I would agree, were not done with proper ethical considerations. The Puerto Rican studies, however, at the time really were done quite well and were welcomed by the women who participated. Beyond that, there were women all over the place who participated in the studies. I was one of them. I was a human guinea pig for the birth control pill when I was younger, and the lower dose pills were being studied. And at the time, my father was one of the researchers, and he believed that the lower the dose, the safer the pill. And he suggested when I was, you know, early married and wanting birth control, he said, well, you know, why don't you try a lower dose pill because it's safer and you can join a study because it's not on the market yet. So I did.
And he was one of the people, your dad was the head of the Planned Parenthood clinic in Los Angeles. He was one of the people who apparently early on had real concerns about the potential effects of the high dose pill.
Right. And I didn't even know this until I started working on this book. I knew, of course, that he was one of the researchers involved in the development of the oral contraceptive. But I did not know that he was involved in the FDA approval itself and that he actually delayed the approval by several months because he was not convinced that we had enough data yet on long-term studies. So that was something I discovered in the process of writing the book.
Let's talk with another Urbana person, line two. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. One thing I was interested in picking up a little bit on a previous caller who mentioned the issue of how we test and how long we test, because one of the things I'm really interested in is that I had heard, and I don't know if this is true, but that in the United States, the dosage that we need for the birth control pill is much higher than in some of the underdeveloped nations because we're surrounded by synthetic estrogen coming from chemical processes and that sort of thing. And what I wonder is, you know, what kinds of measures are included in continuous testing of changes of effects of things because of things like environmental influences that change over time. So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Gosh, you know, that's a really interesting question, and I frankly have not heard anything about the exact issue that the caller has raised about the combination of environmental factors and other factors involved in particular locations, you know, whether in the United States there are different considerations for research than elsewhere in the world. So I don't really know the answer to that. I do know, however, that testing and study continues to go on, and whether researchers have taken note of potential environmental complicators or interactions is something that that I'm not familiar with, but I think it's an interesting question.
We have about 5-6 minutes left. Our guest is Elaine Tyler May. She's professor of American Studies at History at University of Minnesota, and is the author of a recent book that looks at the history of the development of the oral contraceptive. The title of her book is America and the Pill, and it's published by Basic Books. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Back at the beginning of the program, I kind of talked about the fact that when the pill was introduced, there were people who were saying that it would do all sorts of things that it turned out it didn't really do. One of the things that people talked about was addressing the global population problem, particularly in developing countries. And they said they thought that this would be a good thing if women in the developing world also could have some control of their fertility. And interestingly enough, there were some American politicians who, this was during the period of the Cold War, actually thought it would be good to stop the spread of communism if women had that kind of control over their fertility. And it turns out that at least the oral contraceptive that we're talking about here never has really been a factor in the developing world.
Well, it certainly wasn't at the time, because at the time that the pill was being developed and first marketed, throughout the developing world, in the poorer sections of those areas, so much of the population lived in tiny villages where they didn't have access to clinics or medical care. You know, for the pill, you needed an examination. You needed to get a prescription. The prescription needed to be renewed. There had to be ongoing monitoring of the health of the women and checkups. And those opportunities just weren't there. It's also true that in some areas, women were not empowered enough within their own families and communities to be able to assert their desire for fertility control. So it wasn't just a matter of the availability of contraception, but also the opportunity for women to take advantage of it. Now, over the years, in many parts of the world, women have gained much more autonomy in their societies and have been able to take advantage of birth control and other opportunities. And in those situations, it's certainly true that they would still need to be able to afford the products and have access to them. But where those products are available, women around the world are now taking advantage of them.
There for men, there is only one method of contraception, and it's something that's been around for a very long time. It's the condom. That's it. At the same time, it seems now for decades, we have been told that any day now there would be a male pill.
Right.
There would be something like that. That would be the parallel for men. And it's just, in spite of the fact that we continue to be told that any day now we're going to have that, it still hasn't happened, and one really wonders whether it will anytime soon. What's up with that?
You know, in the mid-1950s, in the 1960s, there were reports that the male pill was right around the corner, and we still hear that today. And over the last 50 years, there have been dozens of new products of contraceptives for women, but not one new product for men. And the reason is that, well, there's a lot of reasons. One is, of course, men are not at risk of getting pregnant. So the question of what they would be willing to take to prevent pregnancy is a question. Now, when polls are taken, the majority of men say, sure, I will be happy to take a contraceptive pill as long as there are acceptable side effects. But that question of acceptable side effects is really the big roadblock now. Most of the products that have been tested have had unacceptable side effects, particularly side effects that affect a man's sexual performance. And so it's very unlikely that men are going to take a pill to prevent pregnancy if it has a negative effect on their sex lives.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a major roadblock for the male pill.
You know, one of the things that I found really fascinating, if you look over time at the reaction to the pill, it was apparently the case that while when the pill was introduced, there were some men who thought, well, this is going to be great for men because we're going to have all these women who will now be able to have sex if they want to. So this is a great opportunity for men. There are more women who would be receptive to having sex. At the same time, they were actually were men who saw the pill as a threat to their masculinity. And somehow the idea was their masculinity was tied up with the ability to make women pregnant. And that if it was rendered not possible because the women were taking the pill, there were people who actually thought that would contribute to men's inability to perform.
Yes, that's true. That's certainly something that the experts at the time, a lot of doctors and psychologists who were writing in the popular press, were warning women that they needed to be careful that not all men would find the pill to their liking, because they would either feel that their masculinity was threatened because they wouldn't be having sex with the possibility of creating a life, or as well they thought that if the pill liberated women from fear of pregnancy, a lot of these women on the pill were suddenly much more eager to have sex because they weren't afraid of getting pregnant. And that very eagerness, a frisky woman in bed, a more aggressive woman in bed, some of these experts warned women, you know, watch out, sometimes men are turned on more by a reluctant partner that they have to conquer rather than a willing and eager one. So there was that psychological piece of it as well. We don't have men who've actually said, you know, my wife went on the pill and I was then unable to perform. But we do have experts telling women that they have male patients or clients, if they're, you know, therapists or whatever, who have made them aware of this problem.
Mm. Well, we're here at the point we have about a minute. I'm sorry, there are other things that we could talk about. I guess I find myself wondering that while it's true that maybe we have, we don't want to say understate what the pill did, it seems that in some ways, for some time, we may actually have been overstating what it did.
Well, I think we may have just been looking at the wrong thing. If we don't focus on something like the sexual revolution, but really focus on the tool that the pill has been for women in their own lives, we can't possibly understate overstate the importance of that. Women have made tremendous use of contraception, and particularly the pill, to control their fertility and to control their lives, and that is just huge. There's no way to minimize the importance of the pill for women.
We are going to have to stop there. More in the book if you'd like to read it, and it's a very interesting story. The title of the book that we've been talking about here is America and the Pill, A History of Promise, Peril, and Liberation. That is the subtitle. Basic Books, the publisher. And the author is our guest, Elaine Tyler May. She is Regents Professor of American Studies and History at the University of Minnesota. Professor May, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
We're now at the midpoint of the program. We're going to change. Well, we're bringing you an archive this morning for the first hour. That's from June 3rd. And if you'd like to hear that program again, or in fact a lot of past programs from Focus, you can go to our website. That's will.illinois.edu. In the next hour, we'll bring you an archive conversation that Celeste did on Focus back in the first week of June, and it's all about the incredible world of the ant.
WILL programming is made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, featuring locally grown and organic produce, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields also offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating.
And right now, we'll take a break to bring you an update on the markets and news.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. A lot of green on the screen. We're seeing what this market is made of. Corn, for example, after bouncing yesterday off its 23% Fibonacci retracement, is knocking right again on the highs it made earlier this week. Let's look at the particulars in Kansas City. September wheat is now at 576 and three quarters, up 10. December, 592 and a half, up 8.5. At the Chicago Board of Trade, September wheat is at 560 and a quarter, up 11. December, 586 and a half, up 8 and a quarter. July corn, 375 and a half, up 8 3/4. September, 384 and a half, up 9 1/4. December, 396 and a half, up 9 1/2. Let's go out to May of 2011, $4.10, up 2 1/2. July soybeans, 1037, up 6 1/2. August, 1002, up 6.